Supreme Court justices from both sides of the aisle unite on a major decision about the most common form of abortion in America. We will analyze how an ideologically divided court ended up with a 9-0 ruling.
Pope Francis is invited to meet with the world's Western leaders at the G7 summit in Italy. Our senior Vatican analyst joins to discuss the significance of his attendance.
Has the Catholic Church in America historically failed its Native American followers? U.S. Catholic bishops announced new guidelines for providing better pastoral care for indigenous Americans.
We are processing through the streets of Baltimore, Maryland, with Jesus in the Eucharist. This is a city rich in Catholic history. I'm Catherine Hadro. That story coming up. And we bring new images and experiences from the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage across America. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I agree that we were hoping for a different ruling from the Supreme Court, but the reality is that the court ruled on a legal technicality that was occasioned by the federal government's about-face.
The plaintiff's attorney responds to a lopsided loss in the Supreme Court over the abortion pill mifepristone. Part of the most commonly used abortion method in America will remain legal for now. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado.
And I'm Catherine Hadro. The vote was 9-0. Every justice on the U.S. Supreme Court rejecting a challenge by pro-life doctors who argue the abortion drug poses dangerous health risks to women and girls.
The opinion, written by Justice Brett Kavanaugh, was decided not on the substance of the case, but rather on procedure. The ruling saying the plaintiffs did not have legal standing to bring their lawsuit.
This legal technicality doesn't change the FDA's label, saying that 1 in 25 women will likely end up in the emergency room, or roughly 1 in 25 women. And that means that we still have work to do.
Just 1 week before the second anniversary of the overturning of Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court refused to take a position on access to medical abortions and delivered a disappointing but expected ruling for pro-life groups. At the center of the case, FDA versus the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine, is the safety of the drug mifepristone, the first of two pills used in the abortion pill regimen. The plaintiffs in this case, a group of pro-life doctors and medical associations, argued that in 2016 and 2021, the FDA removed important safeguards in place since the drug was approved 24 years ago, including the need for in-person doctor visits.
When the FDA originally approved these drugs, it recognized that they were high-risk drugs and there needed to be certain safeguards in place.
On Thursday, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected the plaintiff's challenges and sided with the Biden administration. Writing for the court, Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh focused on the doctor's lack of legal standing in the case. He acknowledged that the doctors have sincere legal, moral, ideological, and policy objections to elective abortion and to the FDA's relaxed regulation of mifepristone, but that those kinds of objections alone do not establish a justiciable case or controversy in federal court. Sarah Parshall Perry, a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, emphasizes that the decision does not focus on mifepristone itself.
I think it's important to note that the opinion does not vindicate the safety of mifepristone.
With this ruling, mifepristone's availability remains unchanged. Advocates of abortion celebrated the ruling as a win for their side. And Danko Laboratories praised the decision, saying in a statement, "We are pleased with the Supreme Court's decision in this incredibly important case."
Before we get started,
Vice President Kamala Harris also reacted to the ruling, emphasizing that life-affirming limits on abortion are still on the books in numerous states.
Two-thirds of women of reproductive age in America live in a state with a Trump abortion ban. This ruling is not going to change that.
Dr. Christina Francis, CEO of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs and one of the plaintiffs in this case, released a statement stressing their disappointment in the court's opinion. She said, as an organization dedicated to serving both our maternal and preborn patients, We're deeply alarmed that the FDA's recklessness is permitted to continue unchecked, risking the lives and health of women across this country.
We're hopeful that the FDA will be held to account for putting politics above women's health.
But many pro-life advocates do not see this as the end of the legal battle over mifepristone. Erin Hawley, senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, and one of the lawyers who argued on behalf of the doctors, says the merit of the case remains. Idaho, Kansas, and Missouri will continue to challenge FDA approval of the abortion pill in the lower courts.
The Supreme Court did not dismiss this lawsuit, and that is because there are three states that have intervened in the district court below. Those states will presumably, consider their alternatives, but I would expect the litigation to continue with those states raising different standing sort of arguments than made by our doctors.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops said the court's ruling will continue to put the health of women and girls at risk. Bishop Michael Burbidge, chairman of the conference's pro-life committee, says he's disappointed by the ruling, but emphasized the need to accompany women in difficult pregnancies. He told EWTN News, "The sadness of a woman just being alone, unaccompanied. I don't think people are aware of the harmful effects. It's because we love women that we're concerned this pill remains so accessible. We're going to surround them, hopefully accompany them, love them, provide for them in every way possible."
On the legal front, what is next for pro-life advocates in the battle against mifepristone? And how will this decision shape discussions in state courts?
To help us answer those questions and more, we are joined by Mark Rienzi, president and CEO of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and a law professor at the Catholic University of America. Mark, welcome. Court watchers do not seem surprised by this technical loss at the Supreme Court. Why is this rejection of the pro-life doctors' claims unsurprising?
Thanks, Steph, and thanks, Monse. This is not that surprising, given the way the argument went. And it's important to stress that this is a decision that doesn't address the merits of the claim at all. In other words, the Supreme Court doesn't say what the FDA did was right or wrong. They really just say these plaintiffs aren't the right people to come sue about it. And the reason the court said that is they said that these doctors aren't really harmed by the FDA changing its regulations about how to administer mifepristone. And once the court decides that the doctors aren't harmed by it, then usually they can't be the ones to bring a case.
Mm. Putting on your law professor hat now, since the merits of the case, whether the FDA did the right thing in loosening the requirements for doctors prescribing these drugs, were not addressed, is there an opportunity for a different kind of case to be brought to the court that will protect patients and make mifepristone less available?
Yeah, I think it's possible, but it's difficult, which is why the case ended up this way at the Supreme Court. But you could imagine somebody who has been harmed by the change in regulations. In other words, one of the changes was that you no longer have to have an in-person doctor visit for parts of the process. So you can imagine if someone's been injured by that, that they might be able to challenge it and say, well, I have been harmed, right? Those doctors in this earlier case maybe can say they weren't harmed, but I was harmed because I was left alone in my apartment while this was going on, and I didn't have the doctor visit that the original rules said I should have. So you can imagine a claim like that, but it's pretty hard to change regulations that way.
Well, Mark, the court's opinion makes some significant statements about the rights of doctors to object to abortion and their exceptions from providing abortions in emergency settings, the subject of another pending case before the court this term. In light of that, how significant is it that this is unanimous?
Yeah, I think that is a real silver lining to this decision, is that you do have nine justices saying, look, federal law protects healthcare providers from being forced to provide abortions against their will, even in emergency circumstances or claimed emergency circumstances. And to do that, the court actually wrote into the opinion several concessions that the Biden administration made while arguing the case. So I do think this opinion does move the ball forward on making clear that those protections are real, that that is the right way to interpret federal law. This is not something that you had, five justices on one side, four justices on another, saying, here's how you interpret the conscience laws. Instead, all nine agreed that those conscience laws protect the doctors. The downside for this case was that since those laws protect the doctors, the court said the doctors don't have anything to fear from this change in the rules, therefore they had no case. But for the future, It means the court has interpreted those laws broadly and clearly in a way that I don't think future federal governments could get around.
Well, Mark, let's get into that silver lining. While the admission and oral argument by the Biden administration that broad and comprehensive conscious objections for doctors are protected by the Constitution, does that protect them from regulations made by other agencies like the Department of Labor or Health and Human Services? We know that you have cases surrounding that.
Yeah, I think it does. I think it makes absolutely clear, and again, all nine justices agreed on this, but it makes absolutely clear that if the government is trying to force you to violate your religion, that's a real injury, and that would let you into a case. The problem here was they said these doctors can't say that because they haven't been forced to violate their religion. But in other cases where the government is trying to force you to violate your religion, this opinion is super clear, both that that's an injury that lets you get into court, and also that federal conscience protections stop the federal government from doing that. And those conscience protections apply whether it's Congress or whether it's an agency that's doing that to people.
Mark, this opinion did have one concurrence from Justice Clarence Thomas. He noted that pro-life doctors are not allowed to claim harms on behalf of their clients, something that Planned Parenthood and pro-abortion groups have done for decades, we should note. Was Justice Thomas, was he foreshadowing future losses for pro-abortion groups, or was he simply telling pro-life groups not to adopt those same strategies?
Yeah, it's always tough to kind of get into the mind of a justice and know exactly what he's aiming at. What he said, though, was that we should take Article 3 seriously, and Article 3 basically just limits the courts to hearing cases where someone's actually injured. And Justice Thomas is always very clear and careful about the language of the Constitution. And he said, look, our doctrines about who gets to sue over things have been bent out of shape a little bit in the last 50 or 60 years. And Justice Thomas is telling the rest of the court, we should think carefully about those other doctrines and really enforce them so we get at the real meaning of the Constitution. So if others on the court come around to those views, then that may lead to a tightening of those doctrines. Right now, we just know there's one justice who thinks that.
Mark, the Supreme Court has recently been under fire for seeming partisan. Was this decision meant to send a signal about the court's impartiality or an interest in protecting the rule of law, especially to critics who claim the conservative justices are ideologues and activists? Mm. We know many of the justices are personally pro-life.
Yeah, I think it does send at least some of that message. You know, I think there's a lot of people who don't want to hear that message, frankly, and who emphasize and like to emphasize the partisanship. But yes, right, this is a case where several justices who voted to overturn Roe versus Wade are coming back and saying, but the pro-lifers don't win here because they take the Constitution seriously. And so I think from their point of view, they say, look, this demonstrates that I'm serious about the job. My job is to interpret the Constitution. That doesn't mean the side that you want to win always wins, but it means you have an oath and an obligation. And I think the case shows that they're taking that seriously. And I think the unanimity does help. I think there are some people who like to pit everything as these angry 5-4 hotly decided decisions. And oftentimes the justices do agree on a lot more than we're told they agree on.
Mark, finally, our last question for you. Both Justices Kavanaugh and Thomas noted the limitations on the power of the courts, both in addressing this issue where justices told the pro-life doctors that the executive and legislative branches were a better forum. Are they suggesting Americans are over-reliant on the Supreme Court?
I don't think they say that, but I'm sure that's part of the thinking. And you see the Supreme Court do this from time to time. Chief Justice Roberts did it years ago in the Obamacare case. But yeah, I think the justices do like to send the message that our job is a limited job, right? We're the judges. We decide real cases and controversies from real parties who've been harmed. But we don't just fix every law that's bad. If there's a law that you think is bad, you should think about that and go vote for somebody who will change that rather than expect the courts to fix all the problems. So ultimately, I do think the court was emphasizing its limited role in our constitutional democracy and therefore the bigger role for the people and their elected representatives to fix a bad law if you've got a bad law.
An important reminder in an election year. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you. Good to see you both.
In another major ruling, the High Court struck down a Trump-era ban on bump stocks, a gun accessory that gives assault rifles a rate of fire comparable to machine guns. In an opinion drafted by Justice Clarence Thomas, the conservative majority ruled that the bump stock does not turn a rifle into an illegal machine gun because the trigger must be re-engaged for each additional shot. The liberal justices dissented, and Sonia Sotomayor called the decision deeply regrettable. A gunman used an assault rifle with a bump stock in 2017 to fire more than 1,000 rounds in a Las Vegas crowd within 11 minutes, leaving 60 people dead and hundreds wounded.
There are several more Supreme Court decisions we will be closely monitoring that we expect will hold special interest for the Catholic faithful.
EWTN News in Depth has expert legal analysts standing by to help us decipher those rulings before the end of the court term, expected around the end of the month.
There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News in Depth.
The Catholic Church's relationship with Native Americans, what the bishops have to say.
The Pope shares his thoughts with Western world leaders at the G7 summit.
And we go to the heart of Elizabeth Ann Seton country in Maryland as the National Eucharistic East Pilgrimage reaches a milestone. The United States Conference of Catholic Bishops closed its spring plenary assembly in Louisville, Kentucky on Friday.
During their 3 days of meetings, the bishops shared updates, voted on new pastoral plans, and discussed topics vital to guiding the American church.
After a day of prayer and fraternal dialogue behind closed doors, the bishops held public meetings to share updates on various campaigns and ministries, as well as vote on action items. They heard from Cardinal Christophe Pierre, the Apostolic Nuncio to the U.S., as well as Archbishop Timothy Broglio, president of the USCCB.
Topics of discussion in the public sessions included a pastoral framework for ministering to youth and young adults, mental health, and updates on the religious visa program. The bishops also voted to advance the cause of canonization of Adele Bryce, the laywoman who received a vision of Our Lady of Champion in Wisconsin, the only approved Marian apparition in the United States. Behind closed doors, the bishops discussed the future of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development, the USCCB's national anti-poverty program that faces financial issues amid declining donations.
The bishops also addressed a decades-old issue that many say has been long neglected and overdue for their attention, the matter of the church's pastoral approach to Native Americans.
This week, a renewed emphasis on fixing old wrongs came with something a little unusual. An apology. Mark Irons has our report.
With a desire to, quote, enliven hope for future generations, U.S. Catholic bishops have voted in approval of a new document focused on ways the church can better serve Native Americans.
I firmly believe we have in front of us a very solid document we can all stand behind.
Recalling the historic suffering indigenous peoples faced following European exploration and domination in future U.S. territory, the bishops acknowledged sources of trauma experienced by Native Americans, including epidemics, national policies, and Native boarding schools. The bishops state the family systems of many indigenous peoples never fully recovered from these tragedies, which often led to broken homes harmed by addiction, domestic abuse, abandonment, and neglect. The church recognizes that it has played a part in traumas experienced by Native children. In their new document, Keeping Christ's Sacred Promise, a Pastoral Framework for Indigenous Ministry, the bishops add, "We apologize for the failure to nurture, strengthen, honor, recognize, and appreciate those entrusted to our pastoral care. Moving forward, the church leaders hope to foster healing and reconciliation, set up listening sessions with Native Catholics, and invite them deeper into the sacramental life of the church." The bishops write, "Let us not forget that the sacraments, especially the Eucharist, also serve as a prime opportunity for the church to help heal past wounds."
Above all, the pastoral framework also calls for collaboration and empowerment through resources and formation of Native Catholics as missionary disciples.
The document, approved by bishops at their annual spring meeting Friday in Louisville, Kentucky, includes the input of Native Catholics themselves and offers suggestions for the pastoral care of indigenous youth, young adults, and families. The bishops encourage Native Catholics to take an active role in the renewal of their faith communities, and they note that indigenous traditions can find expression in worship, writing, traditional rituals that complement and are compatible with Catholic doctrine and liturgical practices enhance the prayer life and religious experience of the people. Addressing both spiritual and material needs, the Church Shepherds also highlight a number of unique social issues Native communities face, including a misuse of natural resources on indigenous lands, a lack of quality education, health disparities, racism, and inadequate housing. The document states the Church in the United States must discern how best to allocate resources to support indigenous communities in need. EWTN News In Depth spoke with Sean Chapoose, a member of the Ute Indian tribe, who spoke about some of the hardships with poverty his ancestors endured.
As a people, it's been a rough, hard road. I mean, I feel for my father, my grandparents, the life they had to live. You know, back in them days, they didn't have electricity. They didn't have running water.
He says the Utes have been strengthened by trial.
Because of their resilience and their strength, we as a people have prospered. You know, we haven't sat in a corner and just faded away.
In the bishop's pastoral framework, they note that a centuries-old European justification to enslave, mistreat, and remove indigenous peoples from their lands, made by exploiting papal decrees and referred to as the doctrine of discovery, is not the view of the Church. The bishop states, "Let us be very clear here. The Catholic Church does not espouse these ideologies." Pointing to the Catholic missionaries who cared deeply for Native people's spiritual and material well-being and recalling the lives of inspiring indigenous saints like Juan Diego and Kateri Tekakwitha, the bishops hope good examples of faith from the past and a framework for the present can pave the way to holiness. They write, "The Church must convey the truth that its doors are wide open to Native peoples and their families." Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
Let's check in now with EWTN editorial director, Dr. Matthew Bunsen.
He's part of EWTN News' coverage of the USCCB's spring meeting. Welcome, Matthew. Regarding the bishop's document apologizing to Catholic indigenous communities for a history of trauma caused in part by church abandonment, just how significant is that document?
You know, I think the fruit of many years of work on the part of the bishops, I think the document is a milestone for two reasons. The first is, as you noted, the apology that they're giving, the recognition of the trauma that has taken place. They reference especially the multi-generational trauma, something that needs to be recognized. But then the document is also very much forward-looking. It is not necessarily a reset of evangelization, but it's certainly creating, as the document says, a framework for evangelization, but especially pastoral care. And from that standpoint, I think it is additionally significant in creating a space of recognizing the faithfulness of indigenous or Native Americans, Native peoples to their faith over many, many years. But then moving forward, how do we help them the most? So the great concern for the dignity of the Native Americans and their culture, I think, really emerges in the forefront of this document. Mm.
Matthew, also this week, the bishops discussed the fate of the Catholic Campaign for Human Development. That's the anti-poverty initiative founded by the bishops back in 1969. The program has reportedly been struggling financially. What is its future?
Yeah, the bishops did not discuss this publicly, but it was acknowledged yesterday in the press conference with Archbishop Brolier, the president of the conference, that it has been a topic of conversation in their closed-door sessions. We know that this is a controversial program, partly because of some of the programs it's funded and some of the initiatives that it's launched. But the bigger question is its financial future. Where is it going to go from here? I think the expectation, at least with a few of the people I've talked to, is some type of a reform. But there is going to be lingering controversy surrounding this. And a real effort, I think, to bring it into some better control financially.
Well, Matthew, another lingering controversy was recently revealed. Bishop John Stowe of Lexington, Kentucky, accepted a biological woman living as a transgender man as a religious hermit, breaking ranks with his brother bishops who have condemned sex change interventions. How have the bishops addressed this at the gathering?
Similar to the campaign for human development, this was not addressed publicly or in open session. In his remarkable comments, I think, Archbishop Brolio yesterday gave a very interesting reiteration of the Church's teachings, quoting Francis quite a bit in the document Dignitas Infinita on the Church's opposition to gender ideology, as Pope Francis likes to put it. So this was very clearly setting a table of sorts I had the opportunity to ask Archbishop Broglio at the press conference after the session yesterday about this controversy, and he said that while there hasn't been that type of open discussion, a number of committees at the USCCB have expressed considerable concern about the situation in Lexington. So where we go from here, I would be surprised if there isn't some sort of an initiative made by some of the committees to look at the question of hermits in the church, but also, as Archbishop Broglio put it, the honesty surrounding some of the candidates and also the screening that's in place to prevent this from happening again.
Matthew, real quick, last question. The bishop spent significant time discussing mental health resources. What's the outcome of that session?
Yeah, this is an update of an ongoing campaign by the bishops to promote mental health. One of the more interesting moments came when they had these roundtable discussions. This is all very synodal. I mean that in a very positive way, of their own experiences with the campaign and what works and what doesn't work. I think the bishops are very much in a listening mode in terms of this campaign and trying to introduce as many new innovations as possible, including a mental health chatbot that people can reach out to for help when they're in crisis. So I think this is a campaign that is going to be going on for some time, and I recognize the importance that the bishops are attaching to it.
Absolutely. Matthew Bunsen, thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
And be sure to read our sister publications, the National Catholic Register and Catholic News Agency, to find out more about important discussions at the USCCB's spring meeting.
Next, top headlines in the Week in Review, including a discussion with our senior Vatican analyst about the Pope's visit to the G7 summit. We'll be right back.
The G7 summit of the world's leading industrial nations and Pope Francis's decision to attend the meeting tops the Week in Review.
Pope Francis's arrival on Friday for the roundtable discussion marks the first time a pope has addressed the G7. Through Saturday, leaders will focus on global conflicts, climate change, the spread of artificial intelligence, and on African issues, particularly concerns about uncontrolled migration into Europe. The pope intends to join those pushing for stronger guardrails on AI to make sure it is developed and used ethically. He has said technology lacking human values of compassion, mercy, and morality is too dangerous to develop unchecked.
To discuss the Pope's participation in the G7 summit, let's bring in EWTN's senior Vatican analyst, Francis Rocca, who joins us from the EWTN Vatican Bureau.
Welcome, Frank. You have covered global religion and the Vatican for nearly 20 years, most recently for the Wall Street Journal and now for the National Catholic Register. Is it unprecedented for a pope to attend the G7? And why did Pope Francis accept this invitation?
Well, yes, that's right. That's the first time that a pope has attended a G7 summit. The Prime Minister of Italy invited him, and also a lot of several other non-member guests, including the President of Brazil and the Prime Minister of India. And the pope clearly saw this as an opportunity to speak about artificial intelligence, which is the topic he spoke about, and also, I think, to meet some of these leaders in one place, and was sort of one-stop shopping. He was able to meet President Biden, President Macron of France, and so forth in one location, and with a relatively short trip down to Puglia and back to Rome the same day.
Frank, this topic of AI is not new to Pope Francis. He chose artificial intelligence as the theme of his 2024 peace message, and he himself has been caught in the middle of AI-generated photos that went viral last year. Frank, why is the Vatican invested in this topic of AI?
Well, yeah, he spoke about specifically the concern that there be human control, that this not get out of control of human beings. And for example, with autonomous weapons, he had a striking phrase to the effect that no machine should decide whether a person lives or dies. So he's worried about that. He's worried about, for example, the use of AI in determining in the justice system, in determining whether how people get sentenced and whether they get parole or not. These things need to be under the control of human beings. So that was something that he stressed very strongly here again today.
And Frank, with this attendance at the G7, were you surprised that Pope Francis decided to attend, or is this in line with how he's been supportive of multilateral relations throughout his papacy?
That's right. And he has been. And not only it goes back farther. I mean, the Vatican and the popes have been. Paul VI went to the United Nations in 1965, gave a very dramatic speech calling for an end to war. And Pope John Paul went three times. Pope Francis went to the UN in 2015 and even talked about the possibility of going again this year, although that hasn't been confirmed. This is one interesting point for me is that some years ago I was interviewing Carta Loris Capovilla, who was the private secretary to John the 23rd, and he said that he told me that John the 23rd had been inspired by the United Nations, by the foundation of the United Nations after the Second World War, as a model for the Second Vatican Council. He said, why don't we get together and talk that way, too? So that shows the kind of value that the papacy has placed on these multilateral organizations. Mm-hmm. But another note I think interesting is how far we've come, because right after the First World War, there was the League of Nations, and the Vatican wanted to join and was not allowed to do so. But 100 years later, a century later, we see that the Vatican is very welcome. The Pope is very welcome at the highest level of these. I think that shows that the Holy See has staked out for itself a role as a kind of neutral arbiter that most countries trust.
Mm. Pope Francis also held bilateral conversations with a number of world leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden. They last met October 2021. Frank, what do we know about their diplomatic relationship?
Well, when they met the last time at the Vatican, in the air was a lot of tension over the question of abortion, because Pope Francis has been very strong speaking out against abortion. And we know that President Biden has made the promotion of abortion rights or protection of abortion rights, as he would see it, as a centerpiece of his campaign. Now, probably looming larger has been the questions of peace in Ukraine and in Gaza. And the Vatican has taken a different stance than the White House. The Vatican has tried to be neutral in both conflicts and called for a peaceful resolution of both conflicts. The White House has been strong supporter of Israel and of Ukraine. So there's a bit of tension on that score.
Well, knowing that issue of Ukraine and Gaza, it was speculated Pope Francis wanted to attend the G7 so that he could have a platform to call for peace in both Ukraine and in Gaza. Did he have that opportunity? Mm-hmm.
Well, he met with President Zelensky of Ukraine, and so that was the Vatican has tried for a while to offer itself. The Pope has offered the Vatican as a kind of broker of a peace negotiation. So far, that hasn't happened, but I think he's showing that he's still always available for that and seeking that.
And Frank, it was a very full day for Pope Francis because he traveled to the G7 right after meeting with more than 100 comics, stand-up comedians, and humorists. Here's our Vatican correspondent, Colin Flynn, with one notable Catholic comedian in attendance.
Where are you from?
I'm Colin from EWTN.
Hello, EWTN.
From Ireland originally.
There you go.
This way,
the Eternal Word Television Network.
Whoa, 10 points.
I occasionally catch a mass.
Always good to have another EWTN viewer. That is Stephen Colbert of The Late Show, who frequently mentions his Catholic faith during his shows. Also in attendance were Whoopi Goldberg, Chris Rock, Jimmy Fallon, also a Catholic, and Conan O'Brien. The Holy Father invited the comedians to establish a link between the humorists and the church. Francis notes that they have the opportunity to be a voice of forgotten situations, to highlight abuses and point out inappropriate behavior, to help people think critically by making them laugh and smile. So again, Frank, a full day for Pope Francis. How unique was this papal visit with the comedians on Friday?
Well, I can't think of any precedent for it exactly. I mean, we know that popes in the Renaissance had court jesters. And so in this case, that might be something similar. In fact, there wasn't a lot of joking going around at this meeting. It was a fairly, you know, serious talk. But there was a good feeling. People were very relaxed by all accounts. And so I think it was unusual also in that respect. For sometimes these meetings can be very serious. And I think it was very joyful and relaxed. Mm.
Something not so unusual for Pope Francis. Thank you so much, Frank.
Thank you.
The European Union's parliament shifts to the right after far-right parties won a record number of seats in last weekend's elections. Though the centrist parties maintained their hold of the majority, far-right groups won around 150 of the chamber's 720 seats. The election results sent shockwaves through Europe. French President Emmanuel Macron called for a snap election in France after his party suffered a crushing defeat in the EU Parliament. The wins reflect European voters' dissatisfaction with the European Union and expressed growing concern over the economic impacts of immigration and escalating tensions like the war in Ukraine. These parliament members will hold their seats until the next election in 2029.
Israel's war cabinet is left in turmoil after a senior member resigned last Sunday. Benny Gantz says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made empty promises of total victory for Israel and placed his own personal political considerations ahead of post-war plans in Israel and Gaza.
Unfortunately, Netanyahu prevents us from progressing to the real victory, which is the justification for the painful and ongoing price. That is why we are leaving the wartime cabinet today.
Benny Gantz's resignation proved a blow to Netanyahu shortly after he and the rest of Israel celebrated the rescue of hostages from Gaza. Gantz is seen as Netanyahu's biggest political rival and urged him to hold an election in the coming months. Netanyahu still controls a majority coalition in Israel's parliament, but he could face further criticism at home and around the world as a result of the war cabinet shuffle. The United Nations Security Council overwhelmingly approved a U.S.-drafted ceasefire plan this week designed to bring an end to the eight-month Israel-Hamas war. 14 of the 15 member nations voted in favor of the resolution, with only Russia abstaining. It was the first time the Security Council approved such a measure. The vote on the comprehensive three-stage peace deal increases international pressure on both Hamas and Israel to end the conflict. But detailed negotiations have yet to gain complete agreement from both Israel and Hamas. More than a year into his detention in a Moscow prison, U.S. journalist Evan Gershkovich will stand trial in Russia on espionage charges. Russian officials accused him of spying on a military facility while on a reporting trip in March of last year. Gershkovich, the U.S. government, and his employers at the Wall Street Journal all deny the allegations, and the United States has designated him as wrongfully detained. There is no indication when the trial will begin. If convicted, Gershkovich faces up to 20 years in prison.
The sentencing date has not yet been set for presidential son Hunter Biden, convicted this week on federal gun crimes. Biden left the federal courthouse in Delaware on Tuesday, accompanied by First Lady Jill Biden and his wife, Melissa, after his conviction on three charges related to making false statements to purchase a weapon. When he bought a gun in 2018, he claimed on paperwork that he was not using illegal drugs, which is prohibited when possessing a gun. Hunter Biden has long battled drug addiction, but with no prior criminal history, legal analysts say jail time, if any, is likely to be short. The judge will have other options like probation or home detention. President Biden says he will respect the judicial process, abide by the jury's decision, and will neither pardon his son nor commute any sentence he receives. In a statement released after the guilty verdict, the president said, "I am the president, but I am also a dad. Jill and I love our son, and we are so proud of the man he is today." So many families who have had loved ones battle addiction understand the feeling of pride, seeing someone you love come out the other side and be so strong and resilient in recovery. Jill and I will always be there for Hunter and the rest of our family with our love and support. Nothing will ever change that.
A federal judge has blocked a Florida law that significantly limited gender transition procedures in the state. Signed by Governor DeSantis a year ago, the law banned the procedures for minors and was the first to limit access for adults. U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle sided with advocacy groups and three families, ruling the law unconstitutional. DeSantis called the ruling erroneous and says he will appeal. 20 states have placed limits on gender transition treatments for minors, many of them also facing roadblocks in the courts.
A bill that would guarantee access to in vitro fertilization nationwide failed in the U.S. Senate on Thursday. Democrats forced the vote and Senate Republicans blocked it, calling it a stunt because there are currently no restrictions on IVF. The so-called Right to IVF Act would enshrine into federal law a person's right to receive IVF treatment as well as a doctor's right to provide it. It would override any attempt at the state level to restrict IVF. In a sign of how important reproductive care is this election year, Republicans instead proposed legislation that would discourage states from enacting outright bans on the treatment. The Republican measure was, in turn, blocked by Democrats. The Senate vote came one day after the Southern Baptist Convention voted to oppose IVF. The resolution, approved by the nation's largest and most politically active Protestant denomination, could signal the beginning of a broad turn against in vitro fertilization among many evangelicals and other pro-life advocates. At their annual meeting, the Southern Baptists asked the government to restrain IVF, calling it dehumanizing. The Catholic Church has long taught that IVF is morally unacceptable.
America mourns a civil rights leader. The Reverend James Lawson Jr. passed away on Monday. He was 95. Born in 1928, Lawson spent his life working as a Methodist minister, labor movement organizer, and university professor. He is best known for his leadership during the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s and was behind key efforts for desegregation in the South. Lawson served as a close advisor to the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who called him the leading theorist and strategist of nonviolence in the world. His commitment to nonviolent direct action led him to teach other activists how to remain peaceful when their protests sparked violent reactions.
Up next on EWTN News In Depth, a progress report from the road.
Catherine takes us back on the trail with the National Eucharistic Pilgrims as they continue their mission to spread the good news about the real presence of Christ.
I'm standing outside the very home where St. Elizabeth Ann Seton lived and died. Pilgrims on the Seton route were able to draw inspiration from their route's namesake as they continue to make their way towards Indianapolis. That story on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage coming up.
So much about Jesus, much more than I dreamed, to be honest.
I was not expecting the overwhelming response that we've received almost everywhere we've gone.
Reaction from their time on the road as pilgrim and chaplain share their experiences on the East St. Elizabeth Ann Seton pilgrimage route.
We're nearly at the halfway point of the Eucharistic pilgrimage across America as the faithful process from four corners of the United States toward Indianapolis for this July's National Eucharistic Congress.
Each route, north, south, east, and west, invites pilgrims to pray and reflect at individual churches, shrines, and religious landmarks along the way as they contemplate the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist.
This week, our focus is on the East St. Elizabeth Ann Seton route, as pilgrims made some very important stops. First, at the shrine dedicated in her name in Emmitsburg, Maryland. Then, to Baltimore, the home of the first diocese in America. And then on to our nation's capital, site of the largest Catholic church in North America.
I had the privilege of joining the Seton pilgrimage on all of those stops. I invite you now to experience this faith journey alongside me.
20 days into their unprecedented trek across the eastern United States, pilgrims on the Seton route stopped to pay homage to their patron. Tucked away in the charming countryside of Emmitsburg, Maryland, sits the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, the very site where the first American-born saint lived, died, and is entombed today.
Elizabeth responded to God's call to embrace the fullness of the faith.
Baltimore Archbishop William Laurie celebrated Mass at the shrine, a place he frequently visited during his formation in seminary.
She had an enormous influence. She rooted her life in the Eucharist, and that she had both a great affection for priests, but she also challenged priests to be good priests.
More than 1,000 faithful flocked to the Seton Shrine stop on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, with a procession immediately after Mass.
As you can hear, pilgrims around me are singing
and praying as we are now leaving the National Shrine and making our way to the town of Emmitsburg, following in the footsteps of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton herself.
We came here to give glory to God, to the Eucharist, to his presence in the body and blood.
Seeing the strength in numbers here, that will also bring hope to our cities and to the world.
Emmitsburg local and shrine employee Becca Corbell helped organize the day's events, where Jesus' presence and power were profoundly felt.
My hope has already been achieved. People came out. People showed their devotion. Ugh, I'm going to cry.
My hope is that my town is revived, and my city is revived, and our nation is revived, and it's happening. I'm watching it happen.
Later that afternoon, Seton Route pilgrims made their way to another iconic stop in American Catholicism, Baltimore, the first diocese in the United States. At Cathedral of Mary Our Queen, locals joined the pilgrims for evening prayer, where EWTN's Savoring Our Faith host, Father Leo Petalinghug, did double duty as the homilist and then chef.
Bon appetito.
Serving up the pilgrims' dinner with his local Baltimore food truck, pleading grace and grub.
Feeding people is what Jesus did, so if I'm not willing to feed people, not just in spirit, but also body and mind, giving them something to think about and something to nourish them, then I'm not doing my job as a father or as a shepherd. And so I just realized that the easiest way to touch minds and hearts is to go through the stomach.
The outdoor dinner was welcome leisure time for the Seton Route's perpetual pilgrims, which is where I got to catch up with them in between bites.
Has it really been 20 days? Feels like a little bit. It's been 5 years, but like the best 5 years. So the fact that it's already day 20 and we're like, I know we're not halfway yet, but it's already scary that we're getting there. Because honestly, I think all of us are feeling like, while it is tiring, like we could keep doing this and we want to keep doing this.
Sometimes it is a little physically grueling. We have had 17-mile days where our legs are sore, but we also have days where we're out doing lots of events, we're meeting people, we're in adoration for a large part of the day.
The physical aspect has been a part of this, but it hasn't been as arduous as I feared. What I was prepared for, but that has been overwhelming, has been so much time in the presence of the Lord Jesus. Sometimes I'll have 12 hours of Eucharistic adoration a day. It sort of requires a different spiritual stamina, so I don't take for granted the awesome gift of being in the Lord's presence.
What helps strengthen that spiritual stamina? Wearing a first-class relic of their patron saint, Elizabeth Ann Seton. So
she literally is journeying with us each day as we follow her Eucharistic love.
The next day kicked off in Baltimore. Morning started with Mass at the Baltimore Basilica, the first cathedral in the U.S., where the first assembly of the U.S. bishops was held.
I don't think the importance of Baltimore can be overestimated. Baltimore is really foundational to the church in the United States.
And then Jesus came to the people of Baltimore, with benediction stops along the way.
Processions are usually such a traditional thing for Catholics to do, and I feel like we've gotten away from that in the last 100 years, so it's so beautiful to bring that back and have a revival of Eucharistic love in this country.
The morning Baltimore procession concluded at a historic Catholic site.
I'm standing in what is known as the Lower Chapel at St. Mary's Historic Site in Baltimore, Maryland. This room holds so much significance for American Catholicism. Not only is this where St. Elizabeth Ann Seton took her religious vows, it is where 20 years later, this room became the spiritual home of Venerable Mother Mary Lang and the birthplace for the congregation she founded, the Oblate Sisters of Divine Providence, the first African-American congregation in the U.S.
The next stop was our nation's capital, with Mass at the largest Catholic church in North America, the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C. As always, procession followed Mass. More than 1,000 locals joined in.
We are processing and praying through the streets of the Brookland neighborhood in D.C. This area is affectionately referred to as Little Rome by locals because of the abundance of Catholic religious communities nearby.
Outside the St. John Paul II National Shrine, the nearby Little Sisters of the Poor brought over their elderly residents who patiently awaited to welcome our Lord.
I'm feeling very excited. I was ready since last night.
While we're here today,
to honor and praise our Lord Jesus present in the Eucharist. He is really and truly there present in his piece of bread. Believe, people, believe.
And when our Eucharistic Lord arrived, the elderly greeted him with flowers. Washington Auxiliary Bishop Avilio Menjivar Ayala, who celebrated Mass at the National Shrine and processed with our Lord, said the entire day was a wonderful experience.
It is when we follow Jesus that we come to understand truly the great mystery of the Eucharist. Jesus walking with us and feeding us with his body and with his blood and bringing peace to our souls.
From the tabernacle to the streets, the Seton Route continues on to journey with Jesus and bring him to his people.
Now, here's a look at some of what happened on the other pilgrimage routes this week.
On the South St. Juan Diego route, pilgrims made their way through Louisiana, passing through the French Quarter of New Orleans, and at one point, carrying the Eucharist on a vintage fire truck. In Mississippi, parishioners processed along the coast, participating in a blessing of the Gulf of Mexico, concluding their time listening to the testimonies of perpetual pilgrims. And from the sea to the mountains, pilgrims took to the trails of the Rocky Mountains in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, along the West St. Junipero Serra route. In the largest Eucharistic pilgrimage in Denver history, nearly 5,000 pilgrims attended the procession through downtown Denver, blessing the Capitol and praying for lawmakers.
And from the north, pilgrims processed through the bluff country of Wisconsin, stopping at the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, making it a truly Marian route. Continuing by boat, pilgrims sailed across Lake Shawano in the Diocese of Green Bay, participating in benediction before setting sail. And the countdown continues to the National Eucharistic Congress on July 17th through the 21st, just 5 weeks away, but it is not too late to sign up. To register, go to EWTN.com/Eucharist and receive a discounted pass.
We hope you can join us in Indianapolis for the National Eucharistic Congress. Catherine and I will both be there, and I will be one of the MCs of the event and will help lead the EWTN breakout session called Transforming the World, Eucharist and Evangelization on Thursday afternoon, July 18th.
And I will be part of the team hosting full coverage of the Congress on the EWTN network Wednesday through Sunday. My co-hosts are Father Aquinas Gilbo, University Chaplain at the Catholic University of America, and Pete Burak, Vice President of Renewal Ministries. My in-depth colleagues Mark Irons and Rizal Regis will be there too to capture pilgrim comments and impressions of the event.
We'll be back with some final thoughts when we return. And as we close the program tonight, some personal thoughts.
This is Monse's last regular time anchoring EWTN News in Depth as she transitions from her on-air position to focus more time on her very time-consuming and important role as the president and COO of EWTN News.
Thank you, Catherine. EWTN News in Depth went on the air with our first program in March of 2021. A small but mighty team got this concept show off the ground, an answer to EWTN leadership's desire to develop a program with more time to delve deeply into global news from a Catholic perspective. I've been blessed to interview Catholic newsmakers in the studio, in the field, and to report from across the country, bringing context to news events and issues important to the EWTN audience. As I turn my focus to behind-the-scenes work important to the worldwide growth of EWTN News, it's time now for me to hand off this program to my very capable successor, Catherine Hadro. I will be back occasionally with special interviews, and I might fill in here and there when you are on vacation. But other than that, Mrs. Hadro, I hand the baton to you with prayers and love, knowing that you will faithfully carry on Mother Angelica's legacy through this program.
That means so much, and it was so beautiful to see those flashbacks to those key moments throughout EWTN News in Depth. My words can't underscore enough, Monse, what a phenomenal job you have done in envisioning this program, launching this program, and then hosting it as well for more than 3 years. I am indebted to you. I'm so grateful for you, for your leadership, but also I am so excited for the future of EWTN News with you at the helm. I'm so excited for what's ahead.
It was all done as part of the EWTN family. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News In-Depth. Join us again next week, same time, same place, for more news and reports important to your Catholic life.
I'll look forward to seeing you then. God bless.